Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Spotlight on Youth. My name is Angela Chang and I'm a staff attorney at the Children's Law Center. Spotlight on Youth is a radio show focusing on social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of youth across the country. Spotlight on Youth is hosted by the Children's Law Center, Incorporated, a not-for-profit legal services organization dedicated to children's rights issues. To ask a question of our guests live on air today, you can call 347-994-1149 and push the number 1 on your keypad. You can also type in your question in the chat room if you're listening online. Our guests today are Linda Harvey and Diana Queen. Linda, before we begin full introductions, can you offer us a definition of restorative justice?
Well, restorative justice is all about healing, accountability, and dialogue. It's sort of a different paradigm to what we normally see justice as being. Criminal justice is more of a violation of law in the state, and restorative justice is about crime as a violation of people and relationships. So it's very relationship-oriented, and it's putting the person who has harmed somebody in direct contact with those that they have harmed. And in the criminal justice system, violations create guilt. Justice requires the state to determine blame, guilt, and impose pain and punishment, whereas in restorative justice, violations create obligations. Justice involves victims, offenders, and community members in an effort to put things right. So there's usually, anytime there's a crime or something that's been committed, it definitely has an impact on the community. And so what we try to do is to involve representatives in that community in this process. With criminal justice, the central focus is offenders getting what they deserve. With restorative justice, central focus is victims' needs and offender responsibility for repairing the harm. So restorative justice is very victim-centered, where they have a say in what's going on, but we also are there to work with the offender and representatives of the community to see what we can do to bring about some sort of resolution or healing to whatever the situation is.
Thank you, Linda. And now for formal introductions of our guests. Linda Harvey has been a mediator for 20 years. She's also an experienced social worker, trainer, facilitator, conference planner, presenter, and professional writer. Linda has been a volunteer community social worker catalyst for 50 years, starting and leading over 60 organizations and groups to meet human needs, and has received recognition on a number of occasions, with the most recent on May 6, 2007, with receiving the Sullivan Award from the University of Kentucky, and 2002 when she was inducted as the fifth person into the University of Kentucky Social Work Hall of Fame. Linda does facilitative mediation, transformative mediation, and restorative justice processes. Her experiences span from civil and criminal cases, such as family, workplace, religious, sexual misconduct, human rights, health care, embezzlement, juveniles, child protection, and homicide. She's trained hundreds of individuals in mediation, restorative justice, and conflict resolution. A graduate of University of Kentucky College of Social Work and serves on and is also on their advisory council, Linda is involved in many community activities, including chairing the Community Council for Center on Trauma and Childhood. Linda catalyzed the Model Court Improvement Program for Fayette County Family Court and serves as on the steering committee and larger committee, and she serves as a full-time director of juvenile restorative justice of the Model Court Program, where she directly handles juvenile cases of public offenses and beyond control cases where referred by family and district court, as well as the court-designated worker office in Lexington. She's also developing a volunteer mediation program, Restorative Solutions, for 5 middle schools in Lexington for bullying, neighborhood, and other conflicts brought into school. Diana Queen's professional experience in the criminal justice system spans over a 30-year period. In 1980, she began her career with the Federal Job Corps Center in the mountains of eastern Kentucky. After finishing her employment, there she began her career in law enforcement at a city police department in South Carolina, which eventually led her back to Kentucky, where she became a Kentucky State Trooper and detective in 1986. After honorably serving for several years with the Kentucky State Police, her career evolved again as a private business owner and public servant, serving two terms as a city councilwoman appointed by the mayor to serve two terms on the Woodford County Human Rights Commission. In 1998, she became involved in death penalty cases with the Department of Public Advocacy, which led to her eventual employment with the agency in 1999. Over the next 12 years, Diana would work on the most serious criminal cases, helped create the Kentucky Innocence Project, and served as an adjunct professor, teacher, and mentor to third-year law students at three Kentucky law schools and Eastern Kentucky University. Her involvement in the Kentucky Innocence Project led to 8 exonerations of wrongfully imprisoned Kentuckians. In 2006, she was awarded the Distinguished Rosa Parks Award by the Department of Public Advocacy for galvanizing people into action on behalf of the poor. In 2011, after strong urging from her family and friends, she created a nonprofit and membership organization titled the Restorative Justice Center of Kentucky, where she now serves as president of the organization. So now we've got the introductions through. We'd like to know what led each of you to devote yourselves to promoting this principle and practice in Kentucky. Diana, let's start with you. Can you tell us about your path, your perspective, and your relationship to restorative justice?
Sure. First to say thank you very much, Angela, for having us here today.
Thanks for joining us.
Yes, it's certainly an honor to be here. And I guess for me, it kind of sums it up with three things. You know, through that led me here was my desire to for justice, experience, and desire to see what how we could improve the system. But I guess first of all, you know, I've always wanted personally to be. I have a broad range of experience in the justice system, so I've always wanted to be just where justice was. It never, you know, it has not mattered to me about which side of the law that I found myself on through the years of law enforcement and working with the prosecution or the defense, you know, in cases, but just wanting to improve the outcomes of justice and the outcomes for victims and the process for offenders. Mm-hmm. Those pieces have been very meaningful to me. And, you know, through the experience that I had through the years, I've dealt a great deal with juveniles and with victims, offenders, factually innocent prisoners that have been incarcerated in institutions, and also, you know, families that have been connected with all of that throughout the state. So through those experiences, you know, of understanding the justice system and looking at it from varying perspectives, that all has impacted me and influenced me and inspired me, you know, to always want to do more. And I think, you know, lastly, you know, I think that I've always had just an unfailing desire to want to improve this system or to change the paradigm of how we think about and how we utilize our criminal justice system, and that and to provide a way, an alternative for those for how we engage families and juvenile and both our youth in that system, adults in this system, how we reduce recidivism in the system itself, and how can I contribute now that I've been with boots on the ground and been actually experiencing this system for so long, how can I now take all of that and what can we do, what can we create as an alternative to what I've experience through the years.
Great, and we'll talk a little bit more about your experiences in just a minute. Linda, you're a social worker and creator. Restorative justice seems to be a practice in line with the values of your work. How did you get engaged with restorative justice work?
Well, I'm also a journalist, so I, in the late 80s, for some reason, got interested in mediation. I wrote a story about it, and I interviewed Tom Stefanowicz, who is a law professor at UK at the time. And at that moment, we talked about starting what we called a community justice center in in Lexington. So that led to the Mediation Center of Kentucky, and which was very much based on traditional mediation. So I was with that for a while, and then I sort of evolved to transformative mediation, and then that was the bridge that took me to restorative justice. So my vision was to, I had this vision that was a little bit unrealistic of wanting to do something with death row inmates and bringing them together with the family members that, you know, they have killed their loved one. Well, that was a, actually that vision didn't come true until in recent years, but, and this was, you know, about over 16 years ago. So I began to take volunteers into prisons and work with inmates who have committed homicide, and began to introduce concepts of restorative justice and bring real victims in who have experienced homicide, who are forgiving people. And then that led to bringing some victims together with people who killed their family members and all that. So I did that for about 7 years with a nonprofit called Transformation House, and then I left there in 2003 and decided just to sort of work independently outside of nonprofit, just individually, actually, and began to do mediation, restorative justice work, and that led to family cases and to other kinds of cases. And so my vision was to get restorative justice implemented into the system, and that finally happened about 2 or 3 years ago. Well, first of all, I started doing volunteer mediation. Everything I'm doing in restorative justice is volunteer, mainly. Working with juveniles in the court-designated workers office in 2008. And then that led to what I'm doing now as a juvenile restorative justice of Lexington. So we're working with juveniles, mainly, who have committed offenses. So now we're going into the schools and courts and CDW office. And so it's growing, and I think the message is getting out, and more people seem to be interested in it in Kentucky. And I think that finally it's beginning to be realized.
That's great. Sounds like you both had some really powerful experiences that brought you to what you're working on now. So let's talk a little bit about how restorative justice fits into the juvenile justice system. Diana, do you have some thoughts on that?
Well, I think that it does not. I think that we can kind of first all agree that we want to, you know, our children to succeed and to go down a path, you know, that isn't involved with the court systems, and that we're trying to deter, you know, that being the initial response. You know, we never want our youth engaged in the criminal justice system if we can keep from that. And I think that's something that not only the public certainly wants, but also our great judges and prosecutors and defenders, you know, also desire for that to be the case. And I think that restorative justice supports that ideal. I think that it has the opportunity, it allows for an alternative to incarceration. It allows for the harm that has occurred to be directly addressed, you know, by the offender and the victim, of getting together and actually trying to work out what has happened and how do we really repair it, instead of getting them engaged into a system that's kind of hard to get out of once you get in. And I think that that's a part of, certainly an important part of how that fits in. And, you know, we see this. It's also been where I believe the public is most receptive to this idea of changing a paradigm or looking at an alternative, you know, to the current way we incarcerate our youth, is that the across the country, this is where you are, at least from what I can research and find and in the discussions, that this is where these programs seem to go first. That restorative justice, you know, is best, you know, is first utilized. Often that's what you hear, is that when working in the juvenile justice system, that they have selected this process, you know, to go through to try to resolve these conflicts.
Any additional thoughts, Linda?
Yes, I think what we're trying to do is ultimately prevent the child from getting into the system, the mm-hmm. court system, the cabinet system, the whatever system. Once they get into that legal system, one reason or another, it's difficult to get them out.
Mm-hmm.
So we work very hard in working with not only the juvenile but the whole family, and seeing what we can do to provide resources and work with them and help in identifying what their needs are, which are all individual, to help them achieve success.
Sure. And does restorative justice, does the paradigm ever come into conflict with a young person's legal rights when they're in the delinquency system? Have you encountered any difficulties since the juvenile delinquency system is set up in a sort of an adversarial way?
I have. The work I've been doing what we're trying to do is not do that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do a case, I communicate with the defense attorney and the prosecutor and whoever else is involved. And what I'm trying to do is get everybody on the same page in terms of communication so that things aren't so fragmented and we're all kind of working for the same goal. And that's worked well. I have found a great deal of collaboration with all sides of the group, that's, you know, whoever's working with the child. That includes the school, that includes therapists, parents, you know, whoever.
Sure.
Okay.
And is restorative justice useful for children in dependency, neglect, and abuse matters, or child custody? So can you describe that?
Yes, I've worked with some cases in this area. First of all, it's difficult to work with a child when you know that the parents maybe are more responsible for the child's problems than the child themselves. So there are times when we are required by law to report, you know, the situation to the cabinet. Haven't had many of those in all the cases I've been dealing with, but they are difficult cases. And we're trying to be non-adversarial and, you know, work with everybody. So it's a fine line to walk. I've done some what we call TPR, which is the termination of parental rights, where we come in again as a non-authoritarian person trying to work with the cabinet representative, the GAL, guardian ad litem, all these people, and again try to be non-threatening to the parent who is trying to, whose rights may be terminated. And with one case particularly, we worked enough with the whole system, with everybody involved, that the mom voluntarily terminated her rights. This saved a great deal of money.
Oh.
And I'd like to see that approach used more
mm-hmm.
with these kinds of cases. I think it would save a lot of money and also create a lot of a lack of adversity.
Okay. And just a reminder to our listeners, if you have a question of our guest and you want to ask it live on air, you can call 347-994-1149 and push number 1 on your keypad. You can also type a question in the chat room if you're listening online. What role does restorative justice have to play with conflict at school for children?
We just started a program with 5 middle schools. This came out of bullying cases that I was mediating at the court-designated worker's office. And so I took the parents of the offender and the parents of the victim to meet with the director of the middle schools in Lexington, because there's problems with this in the school system where there's confidentiality rules. So it's difficult if, for example, if it's a bullying case, for the school to tell the victim's family, you know, what's going on and what's happened, when actually the consequences have probably been pretty severe, but the victim doesn't know that. So from that meeting where I brought three parents together, a victim and offenders, this program developed out of that. So with five middle schools, and it happened very fast, within a few months actually. And now this month, we've already trained 16 volunteer mediators to do five schools. We've got everybody, we've got protocols and everything set up with the school system, and we're ready to go. In fact, we got our first case this week. So I don't know how that's going to pan out, but I'm hoping that, again, by doing this in the school system with these kinds of cases, bullying and neighborhood and family conflicts which are brought into the school, and cyberbullying and things of that nature, we're going to prevent kids from getting even to the court-designated worker's office. I mean, that's our hope, you know, to prevent them from getting into the system in the first place.
Okay. That's great. Diana, is restorative justice directly relevant to the community?
You know, I think it certainly is. You know, when you think about the how incidents in crime or where someone is harmed by something, it always touches the community in certain ways. You know, I think that's one of the great values here, that those that are involved in victim offender mediation and are directly involved in talking about the harm that's occurred, that they learn, is that, you know, it goes beyond just the two that are involved. That it touches, either if it's in a school, it touches the school and the how teachers have time to teach and how that is disruptive to their daily life and their job of what they're doing every day when an incident occurs. You know, it goes beyond that if a crime is committed in the community. You know, it all involves, of course, the victim and the offender who committed it, but it also involves where that occurred and the sense of safety that a community feels about what has happened in their community. And community is very much a part of this whole model and process, and oftentimes, you know, people are from the community are brought in and a part of this mediation process. So they can, you know, it gives you a broader perspective so they can see that. So they can experience, you know, that what they do has a dramatic impact, you know, can have a dramatic impact on beyond themselves. And I think that we have an opportunity with also how it's relevant to the community is that, you know, if we provide an alternative way for resolving conflict, it can only be a positive result for the community at large, and it will change the culture of the community. It has an opportunity to change the culture of whatever organization or institution that it's in, and also just the community itself and how we believe about how we deal with conflicts. Where do we go first with that? How do we resolve it? What is at the heart of this, and what the basic tenets of this is, you know, who caused the harm, you know, how do we address it, and how do we repair it?
To add on to that, the example sometimes I use is if somebody went and robbed a convenience store, or shot somebody in the convenience store, that whole community is terrified because of that one crime, you know. So it incites fear. And so if the community is more directly involved in, you know, in the process, it really helps reduce fear and hopefully bring about more of a peaceful environment.
Can either of you share some experiences where you've seen restorative justice in action in a young person's life and how that's resulted?
I've got plenty of examples. I don't know which one to hit on. You know, I'm dealing with the ones that I think we're more successful with in the court system particularly are those who are just new to the court system. When when I'm dealing with a juvenile who's been into drugs and it's a sort of a long-standing problem or has been involved in some criminal offenses for a long time, it's hard to intervene with these kids. But I think with the beginning, those that are new to the system, and basically these are the cases that the county attorney refers to us, we get a chance. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and some of these kids, and one of the things we've been able to do is often the kid, the juvenile doesn't get along with their parent for one reason or the other, and it's, you know, adolescent. So we've been able to work out some alternative guardian situations where, you know, the parent still has custody but gives it to, right now I'm working on one where the boy is going to go live with aunt and uncle, and the parents are going to, you know, give a temporary guardianship to them just to give some space. Sometimes these kids just need space because they tend to project their anger usually on one parent, you know, if they're going through a rough time. And most of these kids have mental health problems. So you're really trying to, you know, help alleviate some of that conflict and give people some, just a break. Mm-hmm. And these kids, most of them I worked with, most of these juveniles, are very smart, really smart. I mean, they do like 29 on ACT, but they're failing, you know. So we make it a point to work with the schools and see how they're doing, how, what we can do there, and just try to work with them in a more holistic fashion.
And I guess the only thing that I would add is that I think that as we look at some of the school systems or areas or alternative schools that have really juvenile detention centers that have really very serious conflicts in there, that that oftentimes I think that people, both the youth that are involved and as the either the victim of the crime or the one that is charged with the offense, you know, really doesn't, at the end of the process, doesn't really understand how anything has changed, other than perhaps where they're now being, you know, that they're being housed, you know, if they're the offender and they're the one that has committed the crime. I don't know if it has really addressed the need that that gets to the heart and to the core of what the issues really are. Families don't feel sometimes, they'll often talk about, you know, I was never involved in this process. I never even knew what was going to go on in this case until it came to court. Mm-hmm. I mean, you will hear that, and that that communication piece is lacking.
And Diana, you worked with Linda to secure a grant for a conference on restorative justice in Lexington. Can you share where that conference is to be held and what it will cover?
Sure. That's coming up on it's a one-day conference held on April 18, 2012, and it's at the University of Kentucky Cooperative Extension Office. And to give the viewers the address, is 1140 Red Mile Place in Lexington. It's going to be a one-day conference from 8:30 to 4 o'clock, and registration is free, and it's limited to the first 100 participants. And the registration for that conference will start February 15th, and it's by email invitation at rjconferenceky@gmail.com if they're interested in that address.
Great.
Okay.
So mark your calendars.
I think what's neat about this is that we're bringing in Mark Yancey, and he is a keynote speaker. He will be the keynote speaker, and he is actually the co-founder of Worldwide Restorative Justice. He's from Canada. It started when he was a probation officer with 22 kids that had robbed 22 homes. And so he and David Wirth got this idea along with the judge who went along with it. What would happen if we took those kids to each of the houses that they robbed and to make it right, mm-hmm. and to meet people and see the impact? The whole thing what we're trying to do here is to let juveniles see the impact that they're having on others, what harm they've done, and to create empathy for whatever has happened. Because often they're still young in their development, and they don't know what consequences, and they don't understand that really well. So they did that, and that's basically how it got started, and it was very successful. And these kids made restitution and did community service and formed relationships with these people. They robbed their homes. That's what it's all about.
And you mentioned, you know, forming relationships with the victims. Is that difficult for from the victim's perspective in coming together to through the restorative justice program?
Not really. The rewarding part of the work is to see them come to the table. They're so angry, but usually nobody has, you know, they're all coming with their different perspectives and different piece of the truth. Well, when they all hear it, because they're all at the same table, they end up exchanging phone numbers and hugging each other and everything. That's sort of the rewards of bringing what you would call enemies together and seeing them after they've learned what really went on. Because nobody has a corner of the truth. They all have a perspective of a little bit of what the truth is. So, no, it's been good. Now, the victim's got to agree to do that, and it's a voluntary process, so sometimes they may be reluctant to do that.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I would say, too, this conference is going to be a great opportunity to really bring, you know, the stakeholders together in the state that received the invitations to come and be a part of listening to something that is an alternative, obviously, that has the ability to shift the paradigm of how people think about how we utilize the system and to learn and ask questions about it and to challenge it, you know, obviously. And I think that it's a great benefit to start this dialogue and to start this discussion with people in our state.
So the Kentucky legislature is in session, and a concurrent resolution creating a juvenile task force has been created. Do either of you see restorative justice as something we might embed into the juvenile code?
Well, I certainly, I guess, am hopeful that that would be the case, that through the task force and through the work that they do, that we will, you know, in 2007, there was close to 1,800 juveniles that were youth that were incarcerated in our jails. That's a pretty high number, and often those things were for minor offenses. It's expensive. It's not only expensive, but it's it challenges how we are engaging so many young people in the system at such an early age. And I hope that what will happen here is that the members of that task force will really consider that restorative justice can provide an alternative to that. That it isn't the total answer to it, but if they would be willing to consider listening to how it's been effective in other places in the United States, how it has changed entire cultures of schools and some juvenile detention centers and other institutions as well, that they would consider that policy is worthy and that it should be written into the code.
I think when we talk about children under 11 who are, you know, being criminalized, or what they're talking about, criminalization, I think definitely restorative justice could be used for these kids, because you're dealing with the whole picture here. The other area that I think it would be helpful to be in is to actually have people mediate cases in the court designated workers office and schools in order to prevent it from getting into the court system. So, and we go with kids in the court system too, but once you get into that system, you've got to really have, you know, prove that whatever is happening here is going to get them out. So it's a little bit longer process and much more involved. But I think if we can get them earlier, that would be very helpful.
great. So you both are engaged in very exciting and inspiring work. What are your thoughts on next steps for the restorative justice movement in Kentucky? What's your vision for that?
I guess my vision is that we start by bringing folks to the table and to have these dialogues and discussions, and that we get from them commitments about what steps are best about how we go about a process of doing this, and where can it be best utilized, and how can it be most effective, and as well as who do we additionally need to bring to the table to have, you know, further discussions with. And I hope that we start with by, you know, as we've started already, which is going into schools and really creating programs, just creating lots of opportunities for restorative justice to work in juvenile detention centers and schools and different organizations, and empowering our community to be a part of that process, and hopefully bringing, you know, volunteers that are willing to come and be a part of what the issues are in their communities and be also be a part of the solution too.
Great. Linda?
I think, you know, we've got some beginnings here in the last few years, and I know that there's an established program now with restorative justice in Louisville. We have one. I know that other counties are considering this and how to get started. So I think that because of the economy, there seems to be more of an openness to want to look at these alternatives. And that's what it is. It's an alternative. It's not trying to substitute, you know, the system, criminal justice system. But it certainly gives opportunities for using existing resources to help kids, but also out-of-the-box resources. And in Louisville and in Lexington, there's two different church groups that are social justice groups that have actually are holding different people accountable. And they're holding us accountable, and I know in Lexington, to say that we will use restorative justice in the schools, in the system, legal system, to actually prevent the school-to-prison pipeline. And that's their interest, in kids being on drugs and, you know, those kinds of things. So that's also helpful. I mean, we need all of us. We need a village to raise a child.
Yes.
And so it's nice that the churches have that. And in Louisville, I know that a group called Clout, which is similar to the group in Lexington called Build, are putting the same kinds of questions to the system there. So that helps too.
So for a community member or a professional that is interested in knowing more about restorative justice, where would you send them first? What should they do about bringing this into their community?
They can contact us.
Come to the conference.
Come to the conference.
Yeah.
It would be helpful. That would be a good step.
It would.
Great. We are about wrapping up our show. Do you have any parting thoughts about the work that you're doing or restorative justice in Kentucky in general?
Well, I think we probably both have a great deal of passion about this work, and it's driven, I think, by also compassion to really try to make a difference in juveniles' lives. And look, there's so many of these children that are in homes that are unbelievable, and all the stresses that they have to deal with. So I think any ways that we can help them and support them in getting on the right path is where we need to be going.
I guess I would echo, you know, Linda's comments that, you know, it takes, we both do have a lot of passion for wanting to create this new paradigm and a new alternative to the justice system, but also that it is an opportunity, it's a real opportunity for not only just dealing with juvenile issues, but dealing with adult crimes and dealing with community issues, and it's an opportunity to resolve conflict, and a way to resolve conflict, and maybe in ways that we haven't thought about before.
To add what Diana said with adults, you know, offender reentry is a big deal now, and again, restorative justice is being used there in helping offenders enter back out into the community and having church groups and other people help them adapt to, you know, the community and not go back to prison. So there's all different kinds of levels, I think, that restorative justice could be helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you both so much for the work that you do, for taking the time to be part of the show, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. We're hoping you all have a pleasant afternoon.
Thank you. Angela. We appreciate it.